This is the WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
Attorney John Day is in studio with us today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. Good morning.
Man, it has been much cooler out there lately. It has felt great.
It is perfect. This is the weather I live for.
That's right. And drive for.
Yes.
And speaking of driving, in this day and age, you know, it's almost worrisome to get on the roadway and, you know, you're just wondering, does the person next to me have insurance? What if they rear end me? What am I going to do in those cases? I guess we ought to talk a little bit about insurance this morning.
Well, thank you. I'd love to. And I can answer the question about, does the person next to you or behind you have insurance? And the odds are that there's a 1 out of 4 chance they do not.
That's not a good odd at all.
I mean, literally statewide in Tennessee, despite the fact that the law requires that every single car have liability insurance, that is insurance designed to protect others who are hurt by the driver's errors, 24.4, I think it is, percent of people on the road have no insurance whatsoever.
That's a huge number.
Well, it is. The way I ask people to think about it is, pretend you're driving down the street to Kroger and look at the cars coming at you on the other side of the road, hopefully. 1 out of every 4 statistically has no insurance.
Wow.
1 out of every 4.
I had no idea it was that high.
It's horrible. And it's worse in depending on where you drive. So, for instance, if you're driving in Shelby County, that number is closer to 40% of people don't have any insurance. If you're driving on Nolensville Road in Nashville, the percentage is very, very high of people who don't have any insurance. If you're driving in Belle Mead, I know you spend a lot of time over in Belle Mead in Nashville.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. The number of people without insurance is, I'm sure, 5% or lower. So it depends where you are, but the fact of the matter is you are at risk. And it's a very scary thing.
And you know, when I said Attorney John Day is here, I should have said, you've been doing this a long time. So you have seen, you know, the pitfalls of what happens when somebody is involved in an accident and that other person doesn't have insurance. You've seen this kind of thing probably day in and day out.
Day in and day out for 43 years.
So what happens when the person who hits you has no insurance, and let's say you're not injured, but yet your car is completely totaled?
Okay, so if the person who hit you in that situation has no insurance whatsoever, hopefully you have insurance on your car. And your claim for damage to your car would be covered under your collision coverage. So collision coverage is insurance which you pay for and get the benefit of if your car collides with something, regardless of whose fault it is. So even if it's your fault, if you are turning into a parking space and cut it a little long and hit the car to your left as you're pulling in from the right, it will protect your car from the damage that you caused. Your liability insurance coverage will protect the other car, the other person's car that you hit. Usually, collision coverage comes with what is known as a deductible. So you have to pay out of your pocket the first $500 or maybe $1,000 worth of damage that is caused in that type of collision.
So I'm curious, and I know this is a question that's probably usually on the minds of many who are involved in accidents and they're not injured, but when you're involved in that accident and it's the other person's fault, if they don't have insurance of any kind and your uninsured motorist coverage covers whatever damage was done to your car, do you have to worry about your own personal rates going up when you didn't cause it?
Legally, no. Legally, the insurance industry cannot raise your rates for making an uninsured motorist claim. Now, are there situations in which a person's in a wreck caused by an uninsured motorist, they make a claim against their own uninsured motorist company, and the next time their insurance policy comes up for renewal, their rates go up. Yes. Because rates tend to go up, just generally, right?
They do.
So linking an insurance rate increase to a claim as opposed to just inflation or insurance industry practice otherwise is very, very difficult to do. But the law in Tennessee is insurance companies shall not increase insurance rates because you made a claim under your uninsured motorist coverage because of a mistake made by another driver.
And again, we're talking with attorney John Day. And, when it comes to insurance, really all insurances, it's a purpose that there's a main purpose why you get it. Obviously to insure whatever it is you own is often to insure your loved ones to make sure you're able to pay for medical expenses if something should happen to them. But when in a car wreck, what does happen with the medical expenses when, again, the person who hit you has no insurance, but yet if somebody in your car is injured, who's going to pay for those damages to that person?
Well, first of all, your health insurance will pay, and hopefully you have health insurance. So let's take a very common situation. A person's in a car wreck. The wreck was caused by an uninsured driver. The injured person, who was not at fault, is taken to the hospital in an ambulance. Health insurance should pick up that ambulance bill. Health insurance should pick up that hospital bill through the ER. Health insurance should pick up the cost of the doctors and x-rays and all the other stuff that you get from 73 different bills, right? That's all on health insurance. Many people have on their car insurance something called medical payments coverage, and that will pay medical bills up to the limit of that, whatever you purchased, usually $5,000 or $10,000, for medical expenses that arose out of a wreck. So what we advise our clients is that you should submit your medical bills in a wreck to your health insurance, but then look to your car insurance policy to pay the deductibles and copays. Because everybody's got deductibles and copays, right?
Unfortunately.
Right. So this the hospital ER may have an $800 deductible. Maybe each of the doctor's bills that you get have a certain deductible that has to come out of your pocket or a copayment. What you do is gather those up, submit them to your car insurance company, and they will reimburse you up to the amount of medical payments coverage you have on your vehicle.
Now, John, you've been practicing law for a long time, and maybe even before you became a lawyer with your own license and all that stuff. I don't know what you did before that, but maybe you were headed that direction towards law when you were in your teen years. I don't know, but
over, I was.
Were you really?
Yeah, I'm one of those people who grew up wanting to be a lawyer.
How do you go about when you're in your teen years doing things as far as getting jobs and all that, part-time jobs, summer jobs, that kind of steer you in the direction of becoming a lawyer? I'm just curious.
Well, the part-time jobs did not steer me in the direction of becoming a lawyer. My dad was a lawyer.
Ah.
So when I was a kid, and I'm talking about, well, your dad did the same thing.
Yes, he did.
And look at you, you're sitting here right now.
That's right.
but my dad would say to me, and he would tell my teachers, Johnny can learn more in a courtroom than he can in a classroom. So he would pull me out of school, and I would go with him to court. And the closest courthouse was 50 miles away. So on the way, we would talk about the cases that he had that day. And he was also trained in history, and we would talk history, do the same thing on the way back. But then I would sit in court with my little blue blazer and, with my little tie on, and I would just watch lawyers and I would watch judges. Of course, I always got to meet the judge because I was there with my dad, and I would watch trials. So that got me interested in practicing the law. just like you got interested in radio, right? And then I did the jobs, and I had a bunch of them because I knew I had to pay my own way. My dad made it perfectly clear that I was on my own when it came to paying for college. So without boring you with all the details, I started my own lawn mowing company when I was 12, had a paper out when I was 11, started working in a grocery store, bagging groceries, and later became a meat cutter all through high school. And then cut meat and tended bar first year of college, worked in a mobile home manufacturer plant two different summers, and then ran my own bar. I was not the owner. I was just the manager of it for my last 2 years of college, working full time.
Quite the background.
I've had a lot. And I also worked for a title and helped a professor open a title insurance company in the middle of all that. So I had, the kids say that their old man is butcher, baker, and candlestick maker. I've not made.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have four brothers and one sister.
So did they also sit in court cases with your dad?
Not as much to their, my brother Tom did. I was the oldest. My brother Tom was next. He was 2 years younger than me. And he had a little bit of that experience. But the younger ones did not, which is too bad.
Did any of them become a lawyer?
None of them became a lawyer. Now, I will tell you, they all have had wonderful careers. My brother Tom became the number two or three person in a Fortune 200 company, maybe Fortune 250. My brother Jim has had a couple different jobs, but now he is a sales manager for a school bus company in Wisconsin. Fourth boy, works for John Deere in computers in the Quad Cities in Illinois. Brother Jeff is in Orlando, Florida, and he works in a sales capacity. And then my little sister, Kathy, works for one of the big banks, and she runs the website for their retirement plans.
Ah, very cool.
So, all but one of us have a college degree. One brother has an MBA. I have a law degree. And none of us have been to jail.
Thank goodness. So, getting back to insurance, the reason why I kind of dated back, what did you do years ago? I'm curious, over all of the years that you've practiced law, is there one type of car accident, an auto accident that comes up over and over again, like maybe involving a commercial dump truck or maybe involving somebody running a red light? What is, I guess, the average or the most routine accident case you see?
Well, the most routine is rear end collisions. Whether the offending car, that is the car that caused the wreck, is a car or is it some sort of commercial vehicle. So I've literally had taps from the rear end where there was $500 in property damage to a rear ender where an 18-wheeler caused the wreck and put the bumper up in the engine compartment of my client's car, and she lost her life. So I've seen a lot of rear end collisions, but collisions of every type that you can imagine. Some extremely weird. I had one gentleman who was riding a motorcycle and got forced off the road by a truck and ended up getting impaled on a wooden fence post.
Wow.
Right in the worst place you can imagine a wooden fence post to go.
That would be horrible.
And they brought him into Vanderbilt on the pole. He was literally on a stick.
Oh, my.
Like Tim Walz's pork chop at the Minnesota State Fair.
And he survived?
He survived.
Amazing.
He did survive. So, a lot of unusual things.
And when you're working these different cases, you've got to look through all of those gruesome photographs taken by law enforcement, I'm sure. You've got to go out to the accident scene to kind of get an idea of how it happened and what the roadways look like.
Right.
There's a lot of work that goes into those.
Well, there is if you do it right.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's important to understand what happened, how it could have been avoided, understanding the landmarks there if there's some sort of dispute over what happened. It does. It makes a substantial difference, I think. There's a little joke. I teach a lot of seminars to other lawyers about how they can do a better job representing their clients. And one of the tricks I use in some seminars is before the seminar starts, I go to two chairs and I put a $50 or $100 bill and I tape it under the chair. And then I talk to people about how to prepare cases and how to get in the field and look at the scene of the wreck and try to understand what happened and talk to witnesses. And as part of that, I ask them to stand up and reach under their chair to see if there's anything under there. And of course, two people find money. And the moral of the story is sometimes you need to get off your butt.
That's right.
To make money and help your client. So I believe in investigations are important. Sometimes it's very, very difficult to investigate cases for lots and lots of reasons. It isn't as easy as many people think, but some level of investigation is important.
Now, I've heard of situations unfolding to where the person has the auto accident and they, you know, call their insurance company after the accident occurs and they say, here's what happened. And then they get told a day or so, a week or so later by the insurance company, hey, it looks like it was your fault. You're the one that caused the accident. And that phone call may come from the other person's insurance provider.
Right.
But they're telling you, you are the one who caused the accident, or maybe it was written up by the officer who worked the accident to look like you caused the accident, even if the officer didn't mean to write it that direction. But how many times in court do you hear that kind of story, and then you're able to prove, you know, not only was the other driver at fault, but that other insurance company should have been paying your client for the accident that their client caused?
Well, I can't say that happens every day or even every week, but it happens more often than it should. That is, a little investigation reveals that the information contained on the police report is not correct.
Yeah.
Or is incomplete. Now, let me hasten to add, police officers have a lot to do. One of the things they have to do is respond to emergency scenes and work with people who have been in car wrecks and complete the necessary paperwork. And from time to time, they make mistakes. Not intentionally, not trying to hurt anybody. They're human. And some of them will even admit, dang it, I blew that one. Or, that wasn't a green car, that was a red car. I know that. Why did I put that? Or whatever it is, right? They're very understanding. The smaller the police department, quite frankly, many times the easier that is to do. In a place like Metro,
yeah,
where you've got so many officers, they're so hard to get. It's difficult. But here's the good news. Police reports are not admissible into evidence in Tennessee. So you cannot walk into court and say, oh, the police said this wasn't my fault. And when you've got to prove who was at fault to win. The only thing the police report can be used for is to help identify who may have been involved in the wreck and the date and time of it. And that's not even from the report itself, but it can help you narrow down your time frame. Okay. So a lot of people are overly concerned with what the police report says about what happened. I won't say it's not important. It is. But in a courtroom, what's in that police report is oftentimes about the cause of the wreck is meaningless.
Yeah. Now, what happens in those scenarios where the driver, who may or may not be at fault, but the driver of the vehicle who you think hit you or caused the accident didn't have a driver's license and didn't have insurance on top of that, when that occurs and that person leaves the scene of the accident with a ticket in hand for not having a license and not having insurance, how do insurance companies look at that? Like, if it's my company that, or I'm the one who's been hit by the person without a license and without insurance, how do insurance companies look at that? Do they automatically say, well, because this guy didn't have a license, he shouldn't have been on the roadway to begin with, so therefore we're going to deem him as it's his fault, and your uninsured motorist is going to cover this?
Okay, so let's call the person who caused the wreck the at-fault driver.
Yeah.
Just to, because we got different drivers, right? So if the at-fault driver does not have car insurance and does not have a license, that in and of itself rarely makes little difference in determining fault. And the reason for that is, in 98% of the cases, the fact that that driver did not have insurance or did not have a driver's license will not be admitted into evidence in Tennessee.
Hmm.
And the reason for that is, in order to for evidence to be admitted, for information to be admitted before a court, the person offering that evidence has to prove that it is relevant. That is, it tends to prove something. And even if it's relevant, the issue is its relevance substantially outweighed by the prejudicial effect? So let's take the driver's license example. What does a person, what role did the failure to have a license have in a wreck?
Well,
I have had none whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, different, maybe if it's a 16-year-old kid who never had a license, or 15-year-old kid. But for somebody like our age, and I'm a whole lot older than you, the fact that we mistakenly let our license not get renewed doesn't have anything to do with the cause of the wreck. And the concern among the courts is, if we let the jury hear that information, they may assume that that is what caused the wreck, and therefore we're going to keep it out completely.
I get it.
Same thing with insurance. Whether or not a person has insurance has nothing to do with whether or not the wreck was how the wreck was caused, right?
That's a good point.
So that doesn't come into evidence. So I want to tell you about one exception to what I just said.
Sure.
And that has to do with the driver's license. If I am a business person and I hire someone to drive for my business, I better make sure they have a driver's license. That's different, right? Because you are entrusting your goods or services or your company name in the hands of somebody else who is a driver. That's part of or all of their job responsibilities. They need a license, and the failure to ensure that that person has a license is evidence of what we call negligent hiring or negligent retention of an employee.
Makes sense.
And that's how you can prove a claim against an employer under those circumstances. Okay? Maybe it didn't cause the wreck, but the failure, particularly if it's a true commercial driver, like a truck driver, they better have a license. It's required under federal law. So, like everything in the law, and this is one thing that drives people crazy, there is a rule, and then there are exceptions. And I just gave you one of the exceptions to the driver's license information gets into evidence. That's one of the exceptions.
Again, we're talking with attorney John Day this morning. And by the way, if you'd like to ask him any questions regarding insurance, just text those questions to us. The number is 615-893-1450. Again, 615-893-1450. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. Again, talking a little bit about insurance this morning with attorney John Day. And by the way, you can learn more about him at johndaylegal.com, and he has offices in Murfreesboro, Nashville, And he'll be happy to help you, or his staff will be happy to help you.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
Hi, this is Tina Fox at the Rutherford Farmers Co-op. Please come and see us for all your gardening, home, and farm needs. We have a great selection of clothing, farm items, and also our wonderful gift department. Please come see us for all your gift items. And we also have local honey. And if you're interested in being a beekeeper, we do have supplies for that. We have from hives to suits to whatever you need to take care of those bees. We're located at 985 Middle Tennessee Boulevard, just off of South Church.
We're excited to announce that Capstar Bank is now officially a division of Old National Bank. All those friends you've made while banking here over the years, well, they're still there. And so are the delicious, warm, homemade cookies.
In Murfreesboro at 2230 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Everything you enjoyed at Capstar, still there at Old National Bank. Old National Bank, ready to serve you.
Old National Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
We're News Radio WGNS, 100.5, 101.9, 1450, online and on your phone at WGNSradio.com. The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
We are broadcasting out of the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios. Middle Tennessee Electric, serving to make life better since 1936. We have attorney John Day, and if you have any questions for him regarding insurance or insurance-related potential cases even, feel free to text those in, 615-893-1450. And here's a question. It asks, if you're allowed to legally drive a small motorcycle that's under 50 cc's on the roadway without a driver's license, do you have to have insurance on that motorcycle? You know, I've heard stories about that, that people can drive without a license if it's under 50 cc's, but I don't know that that's true.
If it is true, it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be, that's right.
And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question.
The law, I guess, talks about how if you drive a motor vehicle on the roadway, you have to have it insured, right?
Right. Yeah. And almost by definition, if it's a 50 cc motorcycle, it's not a motorcycle. I'd call it a mini bike. And the normal adult isn't going to be on it,
no.
Which means it's going to be a kid. And I understand it's a little different if you're out in the country.
Yeah.
Okay. But in town, there's no place for that kind of vehicle or a go-kart or, quite frankly, even a golf cart on public streets. There are certain types of golf cart-like vehicles that are street legal. I understand that. But I see a lot of people running around, I see a lot of kids running around on public streets with golf carts, and it just makes me ill. We've just resolved a case where a mother allowed a 12-year-old to drive a golf cart on a public street, unsupervised. She had a 9-year-old friend on the golf cart. The golf cart tipped over, and the 9-year-old has got a serious lifelong brain injury.
Wow.
And we just resolved that case for a very, very large sum of money, because this girl's life is messed up forever. There is no excuse for that happening on a public street. It just, kids don't need to do that.
And if you're a parent listening, you've got to be responsible in what your children do and not allow them to do things that could lead to serious injuries or even death.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of being a parent is saying no.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is a hard part about being a parent, because many times the no is met, well, Billy's mom lets him do it, or something like that, and there's a little bit of pushback. But saying no is important. particularly when it comes to vehicles that can go 15, 20, 30 miles an hour and they're on asphalt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even on the yard, you know, and riding in the backyard, there is a risk of hitting a tree or some other something else implanted in the ground, and people get hurt and killed. I can't remember off the top of my head how many golf cart wrecks we've handled. Many. Where people have been seriously hurt. I don't remember a case where somebody has died, but this little girl that I mentioned just a moment ago, she was very close to death.
That's scary. And you know, and it's scary for a parent, because the other side of all of this, we know kids do things and get away with things that we tell them not to do.
Oh, you did when you were a kid. Your dad told me that.
Heck yeah. I mean, what kid doesn't, I guess? And you know, that's the sad and scary part of being a parent. You know, your child is going to do stuff that you don't want them to do, even if you tell them not to.
Well, that can happen. You know, you can hide the keys to the golf cart in a responsible way, and the kid can dig them out and find them.
That's right.
Okay. That's one thing. The other thing is go have fun in the golf cart. Here are the keys.
That
is
big difference.
What you should not do.
We have another question here, and again, our number is 615-893-1450. This one says, my husband was sitting at a stoplight and rear-ended by a local pizza driver, I guess delivering pizzas. But it says, our medical bills have already hit around $200,000 because he was badly injured, and I know the company does not have enough funds to cover this. What should I do? And I guess that brings up another question altogether. What does happen if you sue someone who causes an accident with a lot of injury to it that's going to be very expensive? What happens in those cases where the person who hit you, they don't have the money, even if you do take them to court?
Okay. So let's talk about the pizza delivery situation directly. If the pizza delivery driver is not an employee of the pizza company, and many of these people, they try to make them independent contractors, and they're basically out there on their own, running around delivering pizzas, carrying the minimum insurance, which is $25,000.
And they just have personal insurance.
Yes, personal insurance, no company insurance. One needs to explore whether those people are truly independent contractors under the law. Companies try to do this to get around getting a responsible level of insurance. Amazon does this.
I've noticed that.
Amazon is attempting to avoid responsibility for its truck drivers by saying they are independent contractors, and that is beginning not to work because people are figuring out that Amazon is, in fact, in the transportation business and trying to avoid liability. So the first thing I would say is, just because the pizza driver and the pizza company say that the pizza driver's on his own, he's an independent contractor, you need to look beyond that.
Yeah.
Let's assume for some reason that doesn't work. Then hopefully you have uninsured motorist coverage, which is what we talked about, to protect yourself from uninsured or underinsured drivers. If that doesn't work, there is always a potential personal responsibility on the negligent driver himself. The simple fact that you don't have enough insurance doesn't mean you're off the hook for financial responsibility. But it raises the question, well, how do you get money from somebody who makes a living driving a pizza delivery vehicle?
Yeah.
And the answer is, it's really, really, really hard. And it may not be worth it. It's got to be looked at on a case-by-case basis with a lawyer who's willing to do a little bit of digging. Let me share some examples. I had a woman who was killed in a wreck 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And it was a 17-year-old kid who was driving his parents' vehicle. his parents only had $50,000 of coverage. My client incurred $180,000 in medical bills before she died. Obviously, $50,000 was not enough money. I represented that woman's family, the decedent's family, and I insisted that the parents of that boy pay out of their pocket because they lived in a $750,000 house with only a $200,000 mortgage. They had money, and one of two things happened. One of three things. Number one, they didn't understand insurance and bought such a low amount given their station in life. Number two, they understood it but were cheap.
Yeah.
Or number three, they had a bad insurance agent who didn't talk to them about risk. But on the other hand, my client's mother was dead. I made them pay out of their pocket. And we do that in our firm if we believe that somebody is deliberately underinsured for their station in life. So believe me, I don't expect the ordinary pizza delivery guy to be able to afford much more than $25,000. But if you're an airline pilot making what airline pilots make and you have $50,000 of insurance on your car, you at risk for having to pay out of your pocket if you hurt or kill somebody. And it's a judgment call. It depends on lots and lots of factors on how hard we push there. But there's a potential for personal responsibility. That's why I think it is really, really important, and I'm glad we're talking about this today, for that people to understand car insurance and how they need to protect themselves in case they make a mistake, and they need to be aware of the fact that 24.2% of the people out there don't have any insurance, and they are at risk every time they get on the road.
Now, let's say it's a situation where a large truck hits you, causes some very extensive injuries that you're going to have to live with the rest of your life, and you're going to have to live with the pain of it the rest of your life. But let's say that trucking company is worth close to $1 billion in revenue each year, gross revenue each right. year. Well, obviously, if you win the case, you can't expect that company to pay you $1 billion or, you know, even $900 million, right? But at the same time, in those cases, if that case is won and the person wins some astronomical amount of money, what happens as far as, are they ordered to pay that entire amount at once, or do they have the option of saying, our company will go under if we pay all this at once and they'll never get paid, so we need to do something?
Okay, number one, most big companies like that have multiple levels of insurance.
Like umbrella policies
umbrellas on top of umbrella policies. I remember one major company that I had a case against. It had six levels of insurance, and level number six started at $100 million.
Wow.
So a lot of them have plenty of insurance. If they don't, yes, they are responsible for it all at once unless they can negotiate something else.
And they have to do that negotiating, I guess, with the client's attorney, right?
Right.
And the judge then has to sign off on it?
No. They can reach a private deal themselves. The judge, unless it's a minor, okay, or an incompetent person, then the judge would have to sign on it. But if it's a competent adult represented by a lawyer, the lawyer for the competent adult who was injured and the lawyer for the company that caused the incident can negotiate a payment plan. There's all sorts of ways to make it work. And quite frankly, all of that's rarely a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's rarely a problem.
So these big companies out there, publicly traded companies that do have, obviously, in most cases, good insurance to cover them in case somebody does get rear-ended or hit by a vehicle that's one of their vehicles, usually there's not an issue there with the money side of things. The issue really at hand is getting that company to admit we did wrong, or at least finding that in court.
Yeah, for the true big companies, I'll come back to that in 1 second, you still have to prove that that company's driver made a mistake and caused injuries that caused financial loss and pain and suffering and that sort of thing. One of the big struggles right now is that there are a lot of trucking companies out there that maybe appear to be big companies, but they're not big companies. They are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 trucks. They carry the minimum limits required under federal law, which is $750,000. Many of them carry $1 million. Those limits have not been increased in over 30 years.
Wow.
And there's been efforts to get them increased, but the trucking companies are resisting that. So that the real tragedy is, we see it all the time, there's lots of truckers on the road who make a mistake, hurt or kill somebody, and they have insufficient insurance. And then I've already mentioned this situation with Amazon. Amazon will say, well, that's our trailer. See, it says Amazon, but that cab, it says ABC Trucking Company.
Mm.
And that truck was leased from Hertz by ABC Trucking Company, and ABC Trucking Company's not us, and we're not responsible for that driver.
Here's another question, and it specifically asks, what is more valuable? Is it a case where someone is badly injured and the injuries go with them for life, or is it a case where a life is lost? So I guess they're asking, when it boils down to the financial side of things, is a case where there is a death involved going to be more expensive for that company that caused the problem? Or is it a case where somebody receives injuries they're going to have to live with the rest of their life? Is that more expensive for that company that is sued?
It depends on the injuries and what is necessary to address those injuries in the future. Let's use a simple example. If, and I had this case a couple years ago, trucking company hit my client, he lost his arm. He was in his mid-40s, did heavy machinery work. My client's medical bills were $600,000, but he needed a new arm every 2 years at $125,000 an arm.
Wow.
If you do this strict, and he couldn't work again, because heavy equipment, you need both arms, you know, usually. Would the trucking company have been better off economically? What a horrible thing to say. If they'd killed him, yeah. Because it would have, under Tennessee law, they would be limited to pay the initial medical bills, his funeral bills, his loss of future income, and then no more than $750,000.
Yeah.
That's Tennessee limits the liability for killing somebody. But if he'd just been seriously injured, the medical bills over the rest of his life would have added up to millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So, but once again, it depends on who the person is and what the injuries are. If that same person had a lifelong problem, but their problem was they had a whiplash injury, but it was going to affect them for the rest of their life, that's not going to result in as big of damage determination by a judge or jury. So it's all in the details.
And there's so many things you as a lawyer have to factor in for that person who was hit by the vehicle. Gosh, I mean, you even have to factor in, all right, he's not going to be able to drive ever again, but his family, his wife, is going to have to buy a handicap accessible van, and she can never have a regular car again.
Yeah, we employ experts to help us understand how this person can continue to live at home and function in a home environment. So we literally, in the amputation case that I just mentioned, brought in an expert to walk through that family's home and say, we need this modifications to the bathroom. We need this modifications in the kitchen. We need this modifications over here. I've got a gentleman that I represented who lives right down the road here in Manchester. And we set up a whole new house for him. He's a quadriplegic, and he can get from his bed to a shower with a track built into the ceiling that's electronically controlled.
Wow.
So he has the ability to basically get into a shower by himself and then can get back. And the whole house is set up for somebody who's in a wheelchair the counters are higher, mm-hmm. right? Or lower, I mean. The counters are lower. There's no steps. There's his ability for him to get outside and get into the sun without having to slide a door.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things you can do to make life livable.
You've got to examine every single detail. That's amazing.
It is a wonderful way to make a living at helping people try to put their lives back together after these kind of tragedies.
Yes. Again, with us this morning, Attorney John Day. And that's going to do it for today's show. You can learn more at johndaylegal.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. And can I say one more thing?
Sure.
If for all of you going to the MTSU football game this weekend, remember, if you have an extra adult beverage and are worried about driving home, our law firm helps pay for a safe ride home through Lyft.
Positive.
So look for the ad there at the game, and we'll kick in part of the Lyft ride homes. Please don't get in a car after you've been had too much to drink.
Definitely. Again, Attorney John Day.